Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and by WonderFest, the Bay Area Beacon of Science. My name is Tucker Hyatt. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Kerry Nugent, author of Asteroid Hunters. Dr. Nugent is a research scientist at Caltech's Infrared Processing and Analysis Center, and is a member of NASA's NEOWISE mission to discover, track, and characterize asteroids. She is also part of the team working on the next generation of asteroid-hunting spacecraft called NEOCAM. Kerry Nugent received her bachelor's degree from Bucknell University and her PhD in geophysics and space physics from UCLA. She is the recipient of numerous fellowships, including a NASA postdoctoral fellowship and a AAAS, that is American Association for the Advancement of Science, fellowship in the mass media. In 2008, she received UCLA's Excellence in Teaching Award in the Department of Earth and Space Science. Dr. Nugent hosts the podcast Space Pod and has the outstanding distinction of having an asteroid named after her, Asteroid 8801 Nugent. Please join me in welcoming the queen of Asteroid 8801 Nugent, Dr. Kerry Nugent. We will start by reading a passage from her book here, Asteroid Hunters.
For many people, the word asteroid is synonymous with destruction. It brings to mind the extinction of the dinosaurs or images from disaster movies of shattering buildings and cartwheeling cars. But large asteroid impacts are exceedingly rare. And as it turns out, there are actually things we can do now to lower the chance that someday one may harm us. The idea that an asteroid impact can be prepared for, like one might prepare for a big winter storm, can come as a surprise. Metaphorically, asteroids seem to embody our lack of control over the universe. In literature, art, and popular culture, they are acts of God, cosmic phenomena that highlight our own powerlessness. But the reality is quite different. As a species, we have the scientific understanding and technological prowess to actually do something about this particular problem. And it all starts with mapping the asteroids in our cosmic neighborhood. Thanks to the hard work of generations of asteroid hunters, we have found almost all of the biggest, most hazardous objects. By the end of 2011, we had found over 90% of asteroids bigger than 1 kilometer across that get close to Earth. That is, those capable of massive destruction. And because the hunt for these objects has continued since then, that percentage is even higher today. It is crucial we keep searching the skies. Not only would we like to find all the asteroids bigger than 1 kilometer across, it is also a good idea to find the slightly smaller, but still pretty big asteroids that are out there. Asteroid hunters are currently working towards a second target, finding 90% of the asteroids bigger than 140 meters across that get close to Earth. These objects are big enough to decimate a medium-sized country, and so far, only about 30% of these have been found. Asteroid hunting is our responsibility to the rest of the planet. We are the only species able to understand calculus or build telescopes. The poor dinosaurs didn't stand a chance, but we do. If we found a hazardous asteroid with enough early warning, we could nudge it out of the way. Unlike earthquakes, hurricanes, or volcanic eruptions, asteroid impacts are a natural disaster that can be precisely predicted and, with enough time, entirely prevented. As you will see, finding asteroids is a complex task that requires teamwork and patience. Asteroid hunters spend long nights on remote mountains with only skunks and owls to keep them company. We use robotic telescopes that orbit the Earth, diligently imaging the sky every 11 seconds. We send data to a centralized archive called the Minor Planet Center. And all this work is managed from a nondescript building in Washington, D.C., by NASA's Planetary Defense Coordination Office, an unusual place that combines the futuristic work of defending Earth from asteroids with the bureaucratic reality of operating within the U.S. government. So I oftentimes get asked about things that hit the Earth, so I thought I'd read to you the chapter that's called Things That Hit the Earth. I hope you like it. You might be surprised to learn that rocks from space hit Earth every day. Most of them are very small. In fact, the bigger the space rock, the less likely it is to hit Earth. Let's take a quick tour of a few notable impacts. On any given day, about 90,000 kilograms of dust and small rocks hit the Earth. That seems like quite a lot to small creatures like us, but it's only 0.00000000001% of the total weight of coffee consumed by humans each day. A scientist would say that's pretty negligible. A couple of times a year, Earth passes through a region of space where a comet has previously been. The surface of the comet was warmed by the sun, causing water ice and frozen CO2 on the surface to turn to gas, taking dust and tiny rocks with it. The comet left behind this cloud of tiny rocks, which gets pushed around a bit by sunlight and gravity. When the Earth passes through the cloud, those rocks burn up in our atmosphere, causing a beautiful display known as a meteor shower. The best thing about meteor showers, in my opinion, is that they aren't fussy. They last several days, which allows you some flexibility in case the weather is poor. If you can find a really dark part of the world to watch from, you'll see more, but you can be in the middle of a big city and still see a few. I spotted a couple of the Geminid meteors one year from a backyard party in the middle of Los Angeles, which has pretty awful light pollution. If you haven't seen a meteor shower, let me tell you, you are missing out. And to see one, you don't need a telescope or any fancy equipment. You just need a clear night at the right time of year, and you can easily find the dates of upcoming showers on the internet. Grab a friend, a blanket, and some hot chocolate, or a beer, if that's more your style, and lie on your back. Don't look at your phone. It'll ruin your night vision. Look up, wait, and just shoot the breeze. Pretty soon you'll see flashes of light streak across the sky. These streaks of light are caused by very small rocks. Most are about as big as a grain of sand, and some are as large as a pea. These rocks are traveling very fast relative to Earth, and the amount of energy E released when they hit our atmosphere is E equals 1/2 mv squared. In this equation, m is the mass, and v is the velocity of the object. Even though your mass m is tiny, these grains are traveling at speeds of tens of thousands of kilometers per hour relative to Earth, so the velocity v is large, and you get a fair amount of energy released, the equivalent of tens of thousands of light bulbs lighting up all at once. That's bright enough for your eyes to see when you are standing on the ground. It's pretty amazing when you think about it. You're actually able to see the flash from something as small as a grain of sand from over 100 kilometers away. Meteor showers are beautiful and harmless, but what happens when something a bit larger hits the Earth? Well, usually nothing. Most of the Earth is covered in water, so most of these objects end up in an ocean somewhere. And even with 7 billion people on this planet, there's still huge regions of land that are uninhabited. But every once in a while, one of these objects comes down in a populated area. In November of 1954, Mrs. Ann Hodges decided to take an after-lunch nap on her couch. She lived in a quiet town in the American South, about an hour's drive from Birmingham, Alabama. She lay down, covered herself with quilts, and went to sleep. What happened next was extremely improbable. A small rock, called a meteorite, crashed through her roof, bounced off her radio, and hit her in the side. Thanks to the roof and to the blankets, she did not break any bones, but she was left with some spectacularly terrible bruises on her hip, hand, and arm. The rock that hit Mrs. Hodges was once part of an asteroid, but when a rock from space travels through Earth's atmosphere and lands on the ground, we call it a meteorite. Meteorites are named after the locations where they are found, so this one was named Sylacauga after the small town near where Mrs. Hodges lived. Although the meteorite itself did not kill Mrs. Hodges, it sparked an intense media frenzy and legal battle. Her landlord claimed ownership of the rock since it had landed on her property. By the time Mrs. Hodges won the legal rights to the meteorite, interest had waned and she couldn't find a buyer. Eventually, she donated it to the Alabama Museum of Natural History. Some speculate that the stress of the legal battle and fame led to her divorce from her husband and later her death from kidney failure at 52, 18 years later. Take heart. It is extremely, extremely rare for a meteorite to hit a person. But because these things are difficult to verify in the historical record, it's hard to say exactly how rare it is. Mrs. Hodges is certainly the only American known to be hit. Every few months or so, I'll see stories on the internet claiming someone was struck or killed by a meteorite. However, the facts of these cases rarely add up. In the hands of experts, meteorites are easily identified. Oftentimes, the suspect rock is just an unusual-looking Earth rock. And sometimes, explosions blamed on meteorites happen in areas with unclear landmines from old conflicts. Sometimes, it is easier to blame the cosmos for a death than to address a problem closer to home. That's not to say that meteorites are entirely benign. After all, the Sylacauga meteorite, which hit Mrs. Hodges, would have caused her a lot more pain had it not first punched through her roof, clobbered her radio, and thumped into the quilts covering her. And that rock was only 3.9 kilograms and about as big as a small melon. Let's look at something bigger. On February 15, 2013, scientists were ready for an asteroid to zip close to Earth. A small asteroid, about 30 meters across, known as 2012 DA, was going to get particularly close, zooming within the belt of geosynchronous satellites orbiting Earth. This object had been tracked for a year. Its orbit had been computed. There was no chance it would hit our planet. The international scientific community planned observations. NASA organized a press conference with a panel of experts ready to answer any questions. In short, things were taken care of. There wasn't going to be any surprises. But the solar system didn't care about those plans. That morning, something unexpected happened near the city of Chelyabinsk, Russia. A smaller asteroid, only about 20 meters across, sped through the atmosphere 10 times faster than a fighter jet, coming in at a shallow angle. It was moving so fast that the molecules in the atmosphere didn't have time to get out of the way and built up in a layer of plasma that heated the rock. By the time it was about 38 kilometers above the surface, the heat and pressure was too much, and it burst apart in a series of explosions over 4 seconds, leaving behind debris and superheated air. Residents saw a fireball speeding above, which briefly became brighter than the sun, casting its own shadows. They felt the heat from the explosion on their faces, and some noted sunburns, though, being winter in Siberia, it was likely the residents were pretty pale. From the city of Chelyabinsk, this explosion was about 53 kilometers away, meaning it took more than 2 minutes between when they saw the flash of light and when they heard the explosion and felt the shockwave. This event was captured by cell phone cameras, dashboard-mounted cameras in cars, and surveillance cameras. The footage has been invaluable scientifically, allowing scientists to measure the brightness of the explosions and the path the asteroid took. The images were shared immediately on the internet. In fact, one scientist was alerted to the event by a tweet. There's one YouTube video in particular I think captures the feeling of what it was like to witness this event. A couple of men go outside to film the cloud trail when suddenly they're hit by the shockwave. There's a loud series of booms. The camera lens appears to distort for a moment. Car alarms go off and windows shatter. I don't speak Russian, but you can feel the shock and emotion of the men's voices when they react. I was so curious to know what the men were saying that when I learned a summer student working with us at Caltech spoke Russian, I asked her to translate it for me. She did. It turns out it's mostly vivid and unprintable Russian expletives. But the parts that are printable are revealing. They talk of their ears being squeezed by the shockwave, and although one says comet, another exclaims, it's the war. A boulder-sized chunk of the original rock survived the journey through the atmosphere and crashed through the ice of Lake Cherbakal. Residents gathered at the lake, and one recalled in a New York Times article, it was eerie, Mrs. Borchaninova, a barmaid, said Saturday. So we stood there, and then somebody joked, now the green men will crawl out and say hello. Some residents took the event in stride. The New York Times also reported, out on the lake, an ice fisherman who gave his name only as Dmitry shrugged off the event. A meteor fell, he said. So what? Who knows what can fall from the sky? It didn't hit anybody. That is the important thing. I agree, Dmitry. That is the important thing. But although no one was killed, hundreds were injured by the shattering glass, and one man lost a finger. Having seen the flash in the sky, many people went to look out their windows at the cloud trail the object left behind. Unfortunately, many of these people were then injured when the shockwave hit over 2 minutes later, shattering the windows in over 3,600 buildings. So if you do happen to see a meteor flash in the sky, it's probably a good idea to find a safe place away from windows and hang out there for the next 5 minutes or so. The energy released by this explosion was so large, it generated super low frequency sound, or infrasound waves, that traveled the globe. The UN has 283 infrasound monitoring stations across the globe that listen for detonations of nuclear weapons. The Chelyabinsk explosion registered on 20 of these stations, including one in Antarctica, over 3 days as the shock waves traveled around the globe 2 times. But remember that other asteroid that was going to make a close approach that day? 2012 DA-14's 15 minutes of fame were stolen by this newcomer. Scientists quickly determined that the two events were unrelated. Thanks to all the footage of the event, it was clear that the Chelyabinsk meteor had come from an entirely different direction than 2012 DA-14. Scientist Alan Fitzsimmons was quoted in another New York Times article saying, "This is literally a cosmic coincidence, although a spectacular one." It's worth noting that 2012 DA-14 zipped by unremarkably. Predictions of its trajectory were spot on, and it didn't damage any of the satellites orbiting Earth. But why didn't we see the Chelyabinsk impactor coming? Well, for one, it was very small for an asteroid, only about 20 meters, making it difficult to spot in the best of circumstances. Complicating matters, it approached Earth from the direction of the sun, which is a blind spot for night operating telescopes. It's very lucky no one was killed by the Chelyabinsk meteor. Had the situation been just a little different, lives could have been lost. One lucky thing was that Chelyabinsk entered the atmosphere at a shallow angle, giving it more time to be heated by the atmosphere and distributing the force of the explosions over a broader area of ground. Additionally, the object was made out of relatively fragile rock, making it easier for the atmosphere to break it apart. But not all asteroids are made out of rock. A small fraction are made out of nickel and iron. And as you can imagine, a metal asteroid packs more of a punch. A nickel-iron asteroid hit what is now Arizona about 50,000 years ago. There weren't any humans living in the area at the time to see it, but from a safe distance, I'm sure it was spectacular. In fact, 50,000 years later, it is still spectacular. It left behind a giant crater about 1.2 kilometers wide and 0.2 kilometers deep. The asteroid that left this crater was about 45 meters across. That's only two times as long as the one that hit Chelyabinsk. Yet because this impactor was made out of metal and likely came in at a steeper angle, the damage was much more extensive. Even today, you can see fractures in rocks caused by the immense force of the explosion that excavated this enormous hole in the ground. When it comes to asteroids, the objects that exploded over Chelyabinsk and Arizona were pretty small. In fact, they were smaller than almost all of the known asteroids. The bigger an asteroid, the fewer of them there are, so the likelihood of an asteroid of a certain size hitting Earth decreases as you consider bigger and bigger asteroids. Objects the size of the Chelyabinsk meteor hit Earth every 100 years or so. Every once in a very long time, something much bigger comes our way. Certainly the most famous example is the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs 65.5 million years ago. That asteroid, or perhaps it was a comet, was about 10 kilometers across. It can be difficult to imagine just how enormous that is. Here's a trick that helps me. 10 kilometers is about 33,000 feet, which is roughly the cruising altitude of a modern airliner. So the next time you are in a plane, grab a window seat. Imagine a rock so enormous that, resting on the ground, it just grazes the plane's wingtip. It's so wide that it takes your plane a minute to fly past it, and it likely would have been moving over 60 times faster than an airplane when it hit. The impact was almost unimaginably large. Scientists have used computer simulations to try to recreate the chain of devastating events that led to the extinction of over 75% of plant and animal species. But it happened so long ago that much of the evidence of the impact has been erased. In fact, it wasn't until 1980 when a father-son team of scientists, Lewis and Walter Alvarez, recognized that this large impact had happened at all. But despite the tens of millions of years that have passed, two clues remain: an enormous crater just off the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, and a layer of iridium-rich sediment that can be found in locations across the globe. Iridium is an uncommon element to find on Earth, but is prevalent in meteorites. Is the elemental fingerprint of the impacting asteroid. I asked Rowan University paleontologist Kenneth Lacovara about this iridium layer, known as the Cretaceous Paleogene boundary. There have been several suggestions that when the asteroid hit, the dinosaurs were already beginning to die out, plagued by a changing climate caused by volcanic eruptions. Given these new studies, did he really think it was an asteroid that had caused this mass extinction? Absolutely, he said. Below that layer, you can find dinosaur bones. Above it, there's nothing. It's pretty scary to think about something like that happening today. But I don't want you to lose any sleep over this. Consider that the last time this happened, humans didn't exist, and our closest ancestors were little mousy creatures. And, crucially, today we have computers and telescopes and teams of hardworking asteroid hunters searching the sky. Remember, we've already discovered over 90% of asteroids bigger than 1 kilometer across that get close to Earth, objects big enough to cause mass extinctions. And we asteroid hunters are persistent. Given the resources, it's only a matter of time until we find the rest. Thanks.
I understand it's fair to say that there are lots of asteroids.
There are lots.
Your book says that there was the astronomer Edmund Weiss, who referred to asteroids as, and I quote, "those vermin in the sky."
Yes.
Why? Why did he say that?
Well, he was not interested in asteroids. He was looking at things that were behind asteroids in space, such as galaxies and stars. And when you want to study those, you know, the asteroids moving in front of you are always very annoying. But today, you know, asteroid hunters say that other things are vermin of the sky.
Would you mind sharing with us what Nugent's first rule of asteroid hunting is, and maybe the second as well?
Well, I don't know if this can be ascribed to me. In the book, you know, as a device, I come up with rules of asteroid hunting. But you know, these are certainly aren't exclusive to me. But the first rule of asteroid hunting is don't look at the sun. Looking at the sun is pretty bad when you have a telescope. As you can imagine, a telescope is designed to get all the light into your sensors as possible. And if you have too much light, then that goes very badly for your telescope. But there's some surprising consequences of this idea that you can't look at the sun. It means that, you know, it's kind of complicated, but due to the relative motion of the Earth and the asteroids and the sun, sometimes you can miss some asteroids. They can be behind the sun for long periods of time. And so we can't just look at the sky in one night and count all the asteroids. This is something that has taken generations of scientists to work on and discover. Good.
Can you remind us what a near-Earth asteroid is? What does it mean to be near-Earth?
That's a great question. So there's lots of different asteroids in our solar system. A lot of times people think of the main belt of asteroids, and the main belt resides between Mars and Jupiter. But near-Earth asteroids are a different class, and they're defined by their orbits. It's a formal definition. It means that at that asteroid's closest approach of the sun, it is within 1.3 AU of Earth. And an AU is an astronomical unit, which is equal to the distance between the Earth and the sun, the average distance. So this is kind of an Earth-sun plus 0.3 distance is its closest approach. It's kind of, I like to think about it as asteroids within our cosmic neighborhood. They're kind of our next-door neighbors in a large sense.
And a ballpark figure for the number of those that we know of so far?
Well, actually, I looked it up this morning. So there's this great website. It's called minorplanetcenter.net. And the great thing about studying asteroids is that all of the data that we use as professionals is available to the public as well. So you can see the same resources I can. And the Minor Planet Center is responsible for keeping track of all the observations and designating new objects. And on their front page, they tell you the latest stats that are constantly updated. So this is counting near-Earth objects, so both asteroids and comets that get close to Earth. This month, we have discovered 88. As you can tell, there's a lot of people working on this. This year, there have been 408 discoveries. Last year, there was 1,893 discoveries, bringing our all-time total to 15,912. And check it tomorrow, and the number will be different.
And we're confident that none of those has our name on it.
That's right. That's right. All of those are on safe trajectories.
Do you have a personal favorite asteroid, aside from your own?
Well, I do, actually. There's one that's a little more interesting than 8801, which is 1566 Icarus is a kind of nice asteroid. Number one, it has a lovely name, and I think, you know, you're having a lovely name adds something. 1566 Icarus is really interesting because it's a near-Earth asteroid, and it has an unusual orbit that brings it within the orbit of Mercury, so it gets real, real close to the sun, super, super hot, and then it goes out beyond the orbit of Mars, and so it gets pretty cold. So it has this interesting year where it gets cold and hot and cold and hot, and just kind of an odd object.
Cool. Will you tell us about asteroid 2008 TC-3?
Yes.
There's a bit of a story behind that one, isn't there?
There's a great story behind that one. That's a great question. So this was a really interesting object. It was discovered by the Catalina Sky Survey, by Richard Kowalski in particular. And he spotted this thing in the sky and reported it to the Minor Planet Center. And at that time, there was a scientist named Tim Spar, who I interviewed in the book, who got those observations. And he kind of, they got automatically processed by the computing machinery there. And when it was automatically processing, there was a problem with the code, and so it sent Tim an error message. So Tim wakes up in Boston, and he's sipping his morning latte, and he's kind of checking his email, and he goes, oh, that's weird. I've never gotten that error before, and it's a NaN. It's not a number response. And he goes, "That's why is the code, you know, he knows this code super well. He doesn't, can't imagine why this is messing up." And so he takes out his calculator, and he does the calculation a different way, and he realizes that this asteroid that Richard Kowalski discovered is going to hit the Earth in 12 hours.
12 hours?
Yeah, in 12 hours. And I want to be clear that this is a very small asteroid, so nobody was freaking out, you know, like this is a very small thing that was going to burn up in the atmosphere. That being said, though, this is super exciting, because there had never been a time when an asteroid was tracked in the sky and then collected as pieces of meteorites on the ground, and people thought this was a good opportunity to do this. So the whole scientific community all across the world, different people with different telescopes, immediately latched onto this object. And they were observing it, you know, as night fell. As soon as night fell in an area, telescopes there would be on it. So you got hundreds of observations within a second of each other all across the globe, which was super cool. And then people who compute orbits, this is a whole other specialty of studying asteroids, were computing and computing. And the first people to get it right were Steve Chesley and Paul Chodas at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And they predicted that it was going to impact over the Sudan. And actually gave enough warning time to warn the government. And there's a funny side story to this, which is that they, you know, processed this through the proper channels, and Dana Perino, who was George W. Bush's press secretary of the time, remembers the weirdest email she ever got in her tenure was one called Heads Up as the title, and being like, by the way, this asteroid's going to come over to the Sudan. Can you warn the Sudanese government about this? So that was a fun day for her as well. But anyways... they also, as word was getting out about this, somebody also had the very clever idea to alert two Dutch KLM pilots that this was going to happen. They were flying nearby it. They diverted slightly so they could see it come down. They actually watched it come down from that elevated viewpoint, which was really cool. People coming from morning prayers in northern Sudan and southern Egypt saw it as well, which was super cool. And it landed in this very dry, deserty area. Which is a perfect place for a meteorite. You know, if this had landed over an ocean, we would have been in trouble. If it had landed in a rainforest, it would have gotten wet and maybe some of the rocks would have started to break down. But it's a pristine place, and it took a little while, but finally Peter Jenniskins from SETI, who's actually local here, teamed up with Muawiyah Shaddad, who's a professor at the University of Khartoum. They got some students, and they went out to the desert, and they were going to look for this object that had fallen. And they really wanted to find these meteorites again, because it would be the first time we had something we could hold in our ground that we also hold in our hand that we could also compare to. Something we had seen with telescopes. So they kind of spread out with an arm's distance between each other and walked across the desert, and they found a ton of these rocks. And they thought maybe it had all been destroyed, so it was totally remarkable. And these rocks are scientifically invaluable. They have this very rare type of rock, a very rare type of mineral that has never before been seen in meteorites because it's very fragile. So the fact that they got there really fast, you know, in terms of astronomical and geological timescales was just really great. So it was the whole community working together, everyone using their own specialty and communicating well. It was an exciting day. But the big punchline of this, which Tim says, Tim Spar, is that nobody notices this because something else was falling at the same time. It was in October of 2008, and the stock market was falling. And so very few people have heard of this because other people were occupied with more pressing matters.
But it really is correct to say if it's beyond the atmosphere, it hasn't entered the atmosphere yet, it's a hunk of rock. It's an asteroid.
That's right.
Whoa. So, and then it becomes perhaps a meteor and a meteorite if it
right.
hits the ground.
Ah. That's right. That's the progression of words. And it's kind of historical.
Yeah.
People knew meteorites but didn't kind of link everything together and gave it all separate names.
Excellent. All right. Here's a similar question to the earlier. What is your favorite asteroid movie?
I mean, there's so many good ones out there. And it's kind of fun to see a lot of reinterpretations of these. I have to say I do have a soft spot for Deep Impact just because they tried so hard to be scientifically accurate. I really love that about them. They really worked at it.
Does any other asteroid movie come to mind that you'd like to vilify?
No, I mean, I think that science fiction does a lot of good in this regard. I have a very unusual job. there's teams of people doing this, but there's not a lot of us. But people always understand the importance of it because of sci-fi, and that's really great.
How do we know that we found 90% of all sizable asteroids?
This is a great question. And I'm going to cheat a little bit because I think it's best explained with numbers that I can't quite get off the top of my head, so I'm going to look this up. So the basic strategy of this is that, because it's a counterintuitive thing, right? How can you possibly know what we don't know about outer space? So what you can do is if you can exactly model with a computer simulation what your telescopes see, and then also have you compare like a computer simulation of what your telescopes would see with a certain number of asteroids, and then compare that to the number of asteroids that you actually saw, you can tune your simulation until it matches the asteroids you actually saw and say, oh, if there were 20 asteroids out there and we saw 15 in our simulation, and we actually saw 15, then we know we have 5 left to find. That's a vast oversimplification of it, right? This takes many Monte Carlo trials, and it, you know, you do this with much bigger numbers and much bigger populations. That's kind of the gist of it.
Many trips to Monte Carlo?
I wish, right? Yeah. So that's the gist of it. I hope that's clear.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
What makes hunting asteroids fun? The company, the setting, the equipment, the glory?
There's not a lot of glory. it's very quiet, like introvert work. I like it because it's a nice sense of accomplishment. It's nice to, like, you get a good sense of satisfaction when you've accomplished a job and done something permanently. The fact that you say, like, I found that one is really nice. And I want to emphasize that this is, this is also a benefit of teamwork, especially where I work. You know, we rely on so many people to maintain the spacecraft and make sure the software works properly and maintain the computers. And, you know, we're all working together. And so it's lots of people doing their little jobs to make sure that something big gets accomplished.
I think your book mentions that 95% of near-Earth objects have been discovered in the U.S. by us. Is that one of our specialties? Why not more internet? Is there an international effort to find the find asteroids?
So yeah, it's an interesting point. There's certainly international scientists all across the world who observe asteroids and study them, and it's important to have telescopes all across the world and everybody working together to make these observations, like the case of 2008 TC3 that really showed that. But when it comes to near-Earth asteroid discoveries, you're absolutely right. Over 95% have been discovered by NASA-funded surveys. And this is partly because we've had great support from the legislators. There was the George E. Brown Near-Earth Object Act, and there was the Space Guard Act. And this really was an encouragement to find these objects. And it was because of those laws that the research has been done in the U.S. I'm not sure quite why other countries haven't jumped on that yet. Certainly, I think the more asteroids we find, the better. But I'm really proud that this is something that America has done really well. And it's a nice law that has proven to have great results.
How are asteroids formed? Why are there only two main belts in the outer solar system?
So, yeah, outer solar system, we're getting into, like, Kuiper belt objects and Oort cloud objects, which, depending on who you ask, are asteroids or maybe are not asteroids, because it's just a nomenclature thing. But the kind of the canonical view is that when the planets were forming, you basically had, you know, very small things form, and then slightly bigger things, and then slightly bigger things. And some of these things are asteroids, and they simply didn't get any bigger than they are now. Some of these asteroids formed into planetesimals, and then those planetesimals formed into planets. And so a kind of classic view is that asteroids are the leftover building blocks of the solar system. And that makes them very exciting to study, because they're some of the oldest things in the solar system. If you get certain meteorites are, you know, older than the surface of the Earth, which is pretty cool. Almost all meteorites are, actually. And it's also kind of a glimpse into the past. You can time travel in a special way and see what things were like billions of years ago.
Are there any asteroids that we actually expect will hit the Earth? And if so, how big are they?
So there are not, but you are welcome to keep an eye on this yourself. There's a webpage called the CNEOs webpage, and I believe the webpage is cneos.jpl.nasa.gov. And you can keep track of them the same way we do.
Great. And I guess, is it actually fair to say that until the meteors of a meteor shower hit, they're asteroids?
Well, it's hard. It's hard to say, like, what is the smallest asteroid? I don't think we have a consensus on that. I think that most times people wouldn't assume that something the size of a pea is an asteroid, but you might get some contrarians who might argue that.
Is it fair to say that we could do a rather simple internet search to find out when the next meteor shower will be?
Yes, the next one's actually mid-April. And I would encourage everyone to watch it. It's not going to be particularly bright if you are going to try to watch it from this area. But you could definitely see a few. And, you know, if you're spending an evening talking to some friends, it's not wasted anyways. So,
is it true that sometimes we just get lucky and meteor showers are significantly brighter, more numerous meteors than we expect?
Yeah, certainly sometimes. And there's definitely people who just study meteor showers as well, and they have their own theories, and they make predictions, and it's always fun to watch. Personally, I just like watching them.
How can an impact at one spot on Earth possibly affect the entire planet? As in, let's say, the event that did in the dinosaurs. How it seems like that's almost impossible.
It is. It does seem counterintuitive, and I have to make a disclaimer that this isn't my own field of study. I like to find them, not worry about what's going to happen when they hit. But there's a lot of theories that have been proposed. One is that perhaps you have a lot of dust that gets in the atmosphere, and it could make things cooler and prevent photosynthesis. There's some other theories in place having to do with, perhaps there were fires that were started and more CO2, and perhaps there was some sort of global warming event that also was bad. But I'm not particularly up to date on the latest literature there.
What spacecraft are we or have we sent to asteroids?
Oh, so many. I'm almost afraid to say it because I will leave someone out. I can talk about the two certainly that are headed towards asteroids. One is from the Japanese Aerospace Agency, which is called Hayabusa 2. And this is a very exciting mission that's going to the asteroid Ryugu, which I have a hard time saying, but I'm working on it. And that's really exciting. They're going to actually have a rover on the asteroid and several landers, and they're going to try to bring back a sample of the asteroid, which is really great because then you get some of that fragile surface material that we never get in meteorites. There's also a mission, OSIRIS-REx, which NASA launched just in 2016, and that's going to make a sample return from the asteroid Bennu, and that's a really exciting mission as well. So lots of great asteroid science in our future from those two.
Knowing that much of the work being done in your field and related fields is government-funded, is there concern about continued funding?
I hope not. we'll certainly see what the budget is like, but I hope for strong support. We've often had bipartisan support for looking for asteroids, so I certainly hope that continues. As I said, finding asteroids is something the U.S. does very well, so I certainly hope that continues.
Wouldn't an asteroid necessarily have to have come from a larger object? How could the gravity compress it together if this were not so?
So a lot of times, that's a really interesting question. Some asteroids were kind of larger objects than they are now, and then they got fragmented apart and are now smaller. So like a metal asteroid was once part of a much bigger asteroid, for sure, that had a core and a surface of mantle. But there are some asteroids that are believed to be just formed as they are. And the thing is that even though you might have extremely, extremely weak gravity on these objects, it can still be enough to hold them together. So there's asteroids that we call rubble pile asteroids, which are very, very loosely held together, boulders and dust and very small rocks. And those are just gravitationally held together, even though the gravity is weak. For any sort of context, you can put into place that an average person like me would weigh about as much as a cell phone about an average asteroid.
All right, here's a highly personal question, but let's see. My dad was born in 1912. When he was a young boy, he saw an astronomical event that was never explained.
Ooh.
A big ball of light zoomed across the sky and fell to the earth in a mass. In Kansas, maybe a town called Mass. No, in Kansas. He never found out what this was. Could it have been an asteroid?
Certainly. I'd love to see the meteorites there. I wonder if there's something in Kansas that, you know, somebody has in a shelf somewhere that's really interesting. It must have been a very memorable event to see something quite that big coming down.
So while you have seen many meteors, you have yet to see a meteorite. And that's quite rare, to see one that hits the ground.
Right. I mean, I've seen meteorites in museums.
Oh, that's true, yes.
You know, I'm sure everyone has, or they should, because they're pretty cool. Yeah. If you are ever at a museum and there's a meteorite you can touch, I would recommend you touch it, because they're really old. They're probably the oldest things you'll ever touch, about over 4 billion years old, pretty reliably. So if you want to touch old things, go to a museum. Just don't let them kick you out. I feel like I'm inciting bad behavior here.
What is a way, or maybe the three best ways, to avoid an imminent impact?
Well, I mean, the really important thing is that the priority now is like finding these objects. I think it's really important that the way we prepare is to search near Earth space and map it as well as possible, so that if there is an impact of any significant size, we have significant forewarning. And that's something that's very, very achievable. So I would kind of argue that, you know, you might prepare for an earthquake here by stockpiling water and food, making sure you have flashlights and batteries. But the way you prepare for an asteroid is you just look out and you see what's out there. And that'll give you enough time to make an appropriate response. The key thing about asteroids is that they're all very different from each other. As I said, some are rubble piles, some can be made out of metal, some can be made out of rock. And so there's no one-size-fits-all solution to a response. You know, you really want to tailor your response to the particular asteroid. And in some cases, you know, your response can be just like with any other natural disaster. You can just evacuate and get out of the way if it's small. So there's a lot of different options that people have considered.
But if we think of, let's say, on a grander scale, what can governments do if we do detect an asteroid that is coming our way with our name on it? Are there reasonable approaches to avoiding the impact?
Certainly, and there's actually a whole office of NASA that's concerned with dealing with that, and that's called the Planetary Defense Coordination Office. They're very specific about including that word coordination in there, because they're looking to coordinate with other governments and as well as the UN. So they would be looking into that as well.
Do comets hit the Earth? As far as we know.
Yes, they do. Comets are, so just to be clear, comets are different from asteroids in that they have volatiles on the surface. And that can be frozen CO2, which is also known as dry ice, or frozen water. And when they get close to the sun, that turns straight into gas and outgases. So they're similar to asteroids in some ways, but they have this extra outgassing going on. As far as I know, there's no meteorites linked to comets, but it is certainly possible that they have hit the Earth in the past. And it's possible that we do have meteorites linked to comets, but we're just not sure about it yet.
Yeah. In the movie Deep Impact that you mentioned, it was a comet, wasn't
it? Right.
That's right.
And I think that movie was partly inspired by an event that happened in 1996 when the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 hit Jupiter. And that was a really interesting time. And I see in the audience some people are quite young, but I remember when it happened because it was a big deal. It was predicted to hit Jupiter, and so, like astronomers do, everyone aimed every telescope they possibly could to see what was going to happen. And a lot of people were speculating that perhaps nothing would happen. Perhaps it would just, you know, Jupiter's really, really big. This comet's really, really small. Maybe it would just get swallowed up. We wouldn't see anything at all. But it turns out that it left this giant Earth-sized hole in Jupiter that persisted for months that could be seen with backyard telescopes. And it was a very dramatic event. And I kind of wonder, though I have no proof behind this, though if anyone does have proof, please let me know, that the screenwriters of Armageddon and Deep Impact didn't see this event happen and then several years later come out with their movies dealing with a very similar situation.
Hmm. So even though the Shoemaker-Levy comet was not very big, but that small mass compared to Jupiter, moving at the speed it was,
that's right.
The key, I understand. The speed is just enormous. So the energy...
Yeah.
Yeah, it was enormous.
And it was really exciting because it allowed people to peer into Jupiter a little bit. So Jupiter scientists were excited, comet scientists were excited. Yeah. We were looking at all these different wavelength data. One of my favorite things is that Voyager, which was way, way, way past Jupiter at that time, Voyager 2, I believe, was turned back and it was keeping an eye on it as well. So even though it didn't get anything, everyone was trying to use everything we had out there.
If we do discover a comet coming towards us, is there something with enough notice? Is there something that Earthlings could do to deflect it?
So it's the consensus of the scientific community way back in 1993 that if we had enough warning, we could move these things and with enough time. And so with that in mind, you know, this is what makes this a preventable natural disaster. Though, again, the key here is that we need time. And so that's why it's important to find them. It's also important to bring up the fact that once we have discovered these, we can keep precise track of them. We can predict exactly where these things are going. In some cases, in some extreme cases, for like 800 years, we can know exactly where they're going to be. So with that in mind, once we find them, we can really predict exactly where they're going and give ourselves lots and lots of lead time. So search for them now and then maybe respond appropriately if we need to. And maybe we wouldn't need to. Maybe we'd look around and we'd say we're good for 200 years, and that would be great.
Is there worry about picking up microbial life when a nation, say Japan, samples the surface of that asteroid?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah. Or when an asteroid, then a meteorite, hits the Earth, does anyone worry about there being something on board that rock that could...
I'm not aware of anyone who's worried about that.
I guess there's superheating as it goes through the atmosphere. So
they are being heated as well. I know that there's a office of NASA that is concerned with making sure that our spacecraft that go to other planets are sterile, that we're not contaminating someplace else. But I don't think there's any concern about that with meteorites.
Yeah. I do remember a movie called The Andromeda Strain from perhaps the 70s, which explored that theme, I think with at least a modicum of scientific background, too. Can you tell us about this man named Lindley Johnson, what his job is?
Yeah, Lindley Johnson has the coolest title in the world. He is NASA's Planetary Defense Officer. And so he is the head of NASA's Planetary Defense Coordination Office. And he was kind enough to talk to me, and I interviewed him for the last chapter of the book. And so he explains that this office is involved with coordination to the response for looking for these asteroids and planning what they might respond in the end. And it's an interesting job because I feel like it comes with a lot of responsibility. This is the man who would be making, you know, a lot of serious decisions. And it's not responsibility I personally would want. But he's got a very level head, and he partly credits it to his Air Force background, where he's had to make much more urgent decisions. So he's a great person to have in charge there.
What's his title again, please?
The Planetary...
The office is the...
Oh, the office is the Planetary Defense Coordination Office.
Very cool.
Yeah.
What do you think about the project to send chips with sails to Alpha Centauri with lasers described in a recent issue of Scientific American? You're allowed to decline an answer, but does this something that this ring a bell with you?
I'm afraid I'm not familiar with it, but it sounds very cool. I'll have to pick up a Scientific American.
You dedicated your book to, and I quote, the next generation of scientists who have so much to discover. What can we do to support those budding scientists personally and nationally?
Oh, I feel very underqualified to answer that. I think it's certainly important to foster curiosity. And, you know, I certainly benefited from going to lots of science museums as I was a small child, and being allowed to ask questions. I think it's a real shame when kids have, you know, such great inherent curiosity and it's kind of stamped out of them. I will say that every time I've talked to one of my professional colleagues, The total consensus of the, you know, professional astronomers is that the very hardest audience to talk to is small children because they ask such hard questions. So, like, the bravest thing you can do as far as outreach is, like, astronomers, like, go to a bunch of five-year-olds. Like, we're always, like, our palms are sweating. And then we, like, bring back the questions. They're like, oh, God, like, this classroom asked me, why are there planets? And I was like, I don't know. Well, you know, they're just these really big, great questions. And so it's great. Like, it's very invigorating and it reminds you of what you do. But it is challenging because the questions are just really intense.
Why are there planets?
I set you up for that.
This is close. Is the number of asteroids in our solar system decreasing over time?
That is a great question. And it is hard to answer. So, I mean, it depends on how you count them. I don't think there is a net increase in mass in our solar system, but there are collisions of asteroids occasionally. So maybe we're losing a few asteroids as they impact the sun or as they impact planets or they get ejected from the solar system. But we're also sometimes getting new ones as some break apart. So I'm going to leave that answer vague.
Okay. In the movies that depict imminent impacts, we seem to have the government charged with deflecting incoming mm-hmm. object. Will it necessarily require an explosion to do that, or couldn't just lead to greater problems, or is there an altogether different approach?
Yeah, so again, in the last chapter, Lindley Johnson was kind enough to explain these. And there's lots of different options. And again, it's very much because it has to be tailor-made to the individual situation. So for a very small object, what he said was that you might just want to evacuate, as I said, an area, especially if it wasn't very populated. For larger objects, there's a couple of other things that he described. So one is a gravity tractor. So you put a satellite in orbit around your asteroid, and you slowly tug it off its course. And that's real nice because it's very controllable. It's very slow. You can monitor it and see exactly how you're changing the orbit. There's another option, which is the kinetic impactor, where you take something heavy and you hit the asteroid and you shove it off its course a little bit. And so those two are kind of very seriously considered because they're very easy to control and there's very few variables. You know, it doesn't necessarily make for a great movie, like, you know, something very slowly moving over years, but it's kind of what you want in real life, is you want something with very few variables that's very controllable. And the idea of asteroid deflection inspires numerous theories, but those are kind of two that are being seriously considered.
I remember a movie called Seeking a Friend for the End of the World.
It's a great movie.
Is that approximately the correct title?
I believe so.
Yeah, where an asteroid or a comet has an imminent collision with the Earth, and the story is about humanity's desires in those final hours, those final days. And this question pertains to that. The questioner poses it as an ethics question. Suppose you discover a large asteroid which will impact the Earth with too little time to do anything about it, say 24 hours. Do you announce it and worry about hysteria and mayhem?
Well, I have to say I would never be in charge of that decision. And I'm really, really thankful for that. I would have to say you would have to talk to an ethicist about that.
Yeah.
I don't feel qualified to either make that decision or weigh in on it, but it does certainly make for a rich, literary ground. There are several, you know, besides Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, there's another book that's called The Last Policeman, which a bunch of my friends and I were passing around and reading, and that involves a large object headed towards the Earth, and a lot of people have given up, but this one guy, the last policeman, is still investigating murders, and it's an interesting background, and it's an interesting setting.
Would you personally want to know? Let's say you hadn't made the discovery. Would you want to know?
I'm really not sure. Would you want to know?
I think I would. Yeah, I'd want to know at the end. I don't think I'd panic. I wouldn't celebrate. But I imagine that knowing of the time of my demise would be better than the complete surprise. We are in the midst of an extinction event now. Right, the Anthropocene epoch may be marked by a species, large-scale species extinction, perhaps an asteroid impact will be good for the other species. There's a question mark there. What do you think?
I'd rather avoid one. I think it's hard to make that call. It would certainly be a change, but, you know, I think there's a lot of things worth protecting, and this is a worthwhile endeavor to find these things. It's an interesting question, though.
Yeah. Is it fair to say that the public in general has a good understanding of the threat of asteroids, or has it been exaggerated because of admittedly popular and understandably popular movies?
I mean, perhaps. I can give you a stat related to that, which is that, and this is over a decade old, so it's a little out of date, but it's still about right. As an American, your chance of dying from an asteroid impact, and this includes an integrated chance of dying. This includes, you know, a very rare effect where just one person dies, and, you know, a much less likely but more large event. Sorry, I've kind of got lost in the weeds. But your chance of dying as an American is about the same as your chance of dying from a fireworks accident. So it's really quite low. I mean, there's lots of problems in this world, certainly, and you know, you're more likely to die in a car accident, for example, or of heart disease, or of diabetes. But, you know, I'm glad people are working on heart disease and working on making safer cars, and I'm going to work on looking for asteroids.
Excellent. Yes. On your website, Dr. Nugent actually has a website of her own whose URL is
crnugent.com.
crnugent.com. You have an artistic representation of various asteroids, and that is collections of asteroids. And one could get the impression that the solar system, including the area where the Earth hangs out, is crowded with these things. Do you think, is there a way to visualize the scale of the solar system so that we get an idea, even though there are maybe millions of asteroids, hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of near-Earth asteroids, get a gut feel for what the threat is?
So first I have to give a shout out to Greg Kohler, who did that art for me. He was a friend and an artist. But you're right, it's an immense challenge to depict asteroids in any sort of graphical representation because space is so big and the asteroids are so small, it's very easy. You know, you can't possibly show the asteroids without enlarging their size. But I believe you might have a good analogy up your sleeve involving a pin.
Okay. Have any asteroids hit satellites?
Do you want to give your pin analogy? Do you want to give your pin analogy?
I'm sorry. I was busy.
No, that's
this
fine.
This is a tough job to read these
good
questions. And yet,
you're doing a great job.
All right. Thank you for asking. I'll let you know that this is a mental model of the solar system that I think is really helpful to keep in mind. Imagine shrinking the Earth down to about the smallest easily pictured object, a pinhead, the part of the pin you push on. That's about a millimeter across. If we imagine a pinhead Earth and everything else in the universe shrunk commensurately, we can get a handle on the relative sizes and separations of at least objects in the solar system. So if the Earth is shrunk to the size of a pinhead, a millimeter across, the Earth would be a sand grain, a small sand grain, a little bit more than an inch away. And the sun would be about the size of a softball, right? It's much bigger than the Earth, and it would be at a distance about halfway across this auditorium. Softball sun, pinhead Earth, sand grain moon. And we see that, in this auditorium here, we could imagine the sun in the center, the moon and the Earth orbiting, and we'd see in the inner solar system, we'd see also Venus and Mercury. But if they're about the size of the pinhead Earth, we can clearly see that there's a lot of empty space here. The odds of a collision are very remote. And in fact, those objects that might collide with the Earth have probably already done so. As you mentioned, the meteor crater formed by the impact in Arizona.
Yeah.
Long ago. Yeah, Earth has, like the other planets, has swept up a lot of the interplanetary debris. And the universe, sorry, the solar system, at least the inner solar system, is left relatively empty. But still, somewhere out there, I'm worried that there is this, the Chelyabinsk meteor. And it's right to call it a meteor because I guess there were fragments hit the ground.
Yeah.
But it was, you say it's about 20 meters, 20 yards long or wide. Yeah, that's a serious hunk of material. And the energy it released was enormous.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
But it's still relatively small. I mean, no one was killed.
Yes.
It's a relatively small event. But yeah. I love that pinhead analogy. I'm going to totally use it.
Okay. Pinhead Earth. Not too demeaning, I think.
Yeah.
Yes. Have any asteroids, pardon me, have any asteroids hit satellites? Do you track satellites as well for possible impacts?
So there is a group of people who track satellites, but I'm not involved in that particular work. And I'm not sure if one has ever been hit by an asteroid, not to my knowledge. Again, that links into your beautiful analogy. Even near-Earth space is very big, and so there's lots of room between the large satellites for these asteroids to pass.
You told us that asteroids are much more numerous the smaller they get, including
yes.
dust. So I imagine satellites do get hit by space.
Certainly by
often,
very
right?
small objects, yes. Yeah. If you can have these micro impacts that people see on the space station, for example.
Unfortunately, we have time for just one last question,
oh, no.
So I'll try.
They were all great, though. Thank you.
And this is a good one here from the audience. What is your hope for the asteroid hunters of the future? Saving Earth is an awfully good aspiration. What others might there be?
Well, this is work that's been going on for a fairly long time, a couple generations now. And so, you know, it was, there's a lot of really great work by the people who have, you know, worked on this before me. And to be honest, I would love to solve this problem within my lifetime. I would love to be able to find all of these potentially hazardous asteroids and have, future people who study asteroids for science, that'd be great. And people solving other problems would be good. But my hope is that this isn't something that we have to do forever. It's something that we can solve soon and really find these things and potentially give ourselves the warning we need or find out, again, that there's nothing headed our way. That'd be a really lovely thing to do.
Excellent. I hope you've enjoyed. I hope you've enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley, and by WonderFest, the Bay Area Beacon of Science. Again, we would like to thank Dr. Carrie Nugent, author of Asteroid Hunters, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio and on the web. And now, this meeting is adjourned.